it's recording.
Right. Well, thank you, Mrs. Hickson. Right. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Good morning, everybody. Now, as you all know, or most of you know, for about 3 years I worked in Jerusalem in a complex called Christ Church. It was the oldest Protestant church in the Middle East, a guest house. And sometimes in the evening they would have lectures in the church. And one evening they gave a lecture in the church about the Jewish weddings and Jesus. And so I went in there. As far as I could see, I was the only person from Christ Church there. And then about 5 minutes before the meeting started, this great big guy, burly guy, kippah, Jewish guy, he came and he plonked himself in the front row and sort of did that. And sort of glared at the speaker. And I sort of looked at him, he looked at me. And then Kevin, a friend of mine, came up next to me and says, "That guy is trouble. Keep an eye on him." So I sort of gulped, and then Kevin vanished. Didn't know where Kevin went. So anyway, the meeting started, and about halfway through this meeting on Jewish weddings and Jesus, he took over the meeting. So I sort of looked around the room, and as far as I could see, I was the only person from Christ Church, actually. Yeah, the only male anyway. So I thought it was up to me to find out. So I went up and asked her, "Is this gentleman with you?" And she said, "No, I've never seen him before in my life." So I said, "Look, this is a private meeting. Do you mind, you know, sitting down?" So he yelled at me, asked if I wanted to fight. So I said, "Well, no, I don't particularly want to fight, but I would like you to sit down or leave, you know, because this is a private meeting." So he again yelled at me, "Do you want to fight?" So this time I thought, well, it's going to happen anyway. So I squared up to him as best I could, and pretty sure my evening was about to be ruined. So at this time, Kevin appeared next to me, and we both asked him to leave. So at this point, he sort of ran for the exit, and we ran after him. And this gentleman held the glass door and smashed it into Kevin's wrist as he came past, and basically slitting his wrist. But that time we didn't know anything. We didn't know that he'd been wounded. So basically we were all on the floor with this fella. Well, two of us, we were on top of him. But we were both quite, at least I was quite strong in those days. Not anymore, but I was in those days. And so was Kevin, but we couldn't do anything with him. You know, he had seven demons in him, I think. So eventually I got bored and said, "In the name of Jesus, stop." And it was a bit like pointing a finger at somebody saying bang and the guy dropping dead. He suddenly went all limp, and he said, "I'll stop." So we sat on him for a while, and then the police arrived and tried to put the cuffs on me. But they said, "No, it's him, you know, the one we're sitting on. He put the cuffs on him." So the following day, there is a point to all this. The following day, Kevin and I had to go and make our statements. Kevin went in and he made his statement in the police station. And then I went in and I made my statement. Now, there were two woman police officers there. One of them, very butch, he had a face like basically a Soviet Army boot. Not very lovely at all. And she said, "According to all the reports, Mr. Hickson, you savagely attacked this man. Did you? It is against the law, by the way, to attack people in Israel." I said, "Really?" And "Did you attack him?" And I said, no. "Do you mind if I make my statement?" So Soviet boot left, and a much more gorgeous woman police officer took over. Her name was Diana, and I think she was an Arab. She was absolutely gorgeous. So she interviewed me, and at the end of the interview, she allowed me to leave. And then she called me back about 10 minutes later after I'd left, because Christchurch is only about a 30-second walk from to the police station, very close. And I came in again, and she said, well, apologize, I was supposed to arrest you after the interview, but I forgot. So you're arrested, you know. So you're afraid you'll have to apply for bail. 5,000 shekels, 5,000 shekels, and if you don't pay, you'll have to stay here. So I thought, well, I don't mind staying here with her. But anyway, they didn't pay the bail, but somebody came along. So I was quite happy, you know, this young lady. So if I don't come when she asks, she'll need at least 5,000 shekels compensation. So anyway, she must like me. I was eventually cleared of my name was eventually cleared after a few weeks, and I was taken off bail. But the point of all this, apart from being a true story, is that this lecture on Jewish weddings and Jesus wasn't finished. You know, everybody sort of tiptoed out over the broken glass, and the lecture never got finished. So I'm going to finish it today. So, he was very burly. Yeah. But there is a sequel to it, but I won't go into the sequel. It was a few weeks ago. Joy gave us a talk on the Bride of Christ. I think that was a topic. So I want to take away what anything she said, but build on what she said in that topic. Now, a Jewish wedding, obviously there are many different types of Jewish wedding. I mean, most Jewish weddings today are a bit like our wedding. You boy meets girl, they get married, they see somebody else, they go and they divorce, they go and marry her. I mean, it's basically the same as other Western society. But there are traditional Jewish weddings. And there was a Jewish wedding that was extant in the time of Jesus. And in fact, it's also continues to this day among certain sections of the Jewish community. Now, what would happen is, forget boy meets girl. That didn't happen. They didn't have dating as we know it. Okay, you might meet people of the opposite sex when you were working, but there's no dating wasn't on. It was the father of the man, of the boy, the bloke, he would tell the son who he was going to marry. And it was basically, they were arranged marriages. Now, an arranged marriage in this culture sounds terrible, but it can work, provided both the man and the woman accept the fact that the marriage is arranged. If they're used to it, it can work. Because if you have children and you love them, you are going to make sure that your son or your daughter gets the best match possible. You're not going to be swayed by the fact that she's beautiful or he's handsome. You know, you're going to find a suitable match for your son or your daughter. You're going to do the best you can. And the same with the bride. So they have your interests and the bride's interests at heart. So it can work. What doesn't work is when you mix cultures. Now, I had a couple of friends who were Indian. They lived in, where was it, Amritsar, I think it was. They were both very westernized. They were both doctors. But they had an arranged marriage. They were married in Amritsar in an arranged marriage. Worked very well in India, because if you don't get on with your husband or your wife, you've got the in-laws and you make friends with them. But then they came to England and they realized they didn't have their family structure. They had to rely on each other. difficult one, you know, in an arranged marriage. So they had to sort of completely rebuild their marriage from scratch when they came to England. They're in the Watford Church for a while. So anyway, you got the father of the potential bridegroom. He goes to the father of the bride, and they agree on a price. And then they agree on a price, and the boy meets the girl, and they agree to marry. So the girl has to agree. I know in some parts of the Muslim world and the Soviet Union, whether the girl agrees or not is irrelevant. She's going to get married anyway. But in the most Jewish culture, the girl has to agree, and so does the boy. So they agree on a price, and then the potential bridegroom and the bride sit down together, and they have a glass of wine together as a symbol. Well, he gives her a gift, like a ring or something like that, and then they have a glass of wine together to toast the covenant they have made with each other. And this is the point. All the legal bit is done at betrothal, not so much at the marriage. In Western culture, as you know, if you get engaged and then you break it off, it's very sad, obviously. Very sad indeed. But no, there's no covenant that's been broken. You are free to break off a marriage until the day before the wedding, until you say I do. You're free to break it off. When you're betrothed, it's different. You are married, but it's not consummated. There's other things to do down the line before you're actually officially married, but you are married. You get my drift. So when the potential bridegroom and the bride, they drink wine together. The bridegroom then says, I've got to go and prepare a place for you, and then I'm going to return and collect you. So off he goes, and then he starts to build a place where they will live, or they will have their honeymoon. This normally would take about a year, but it could take more. Now, the time of the wedding is nothing to do with the bridegroom. If you go along and you see the bridegroom building the house, or the wing on the house where they're going to have their honeymoon, they're going to live for a while, and ask him, when's the happy day? He'll say, I don't know. I'm the last person to be told these things. Ask my father. He knows. Because if it was left to the potential bridegroom, he'd just stick up a Bedouin tent and say, that's it, right, ready, off, and go and get the bride. The father is not in quite such a hurry. The father says, right, let's get it right. Let's get the right type of wood. Let's do this properly. And when the father considers that the place is ready, then he says, right, off you go. And so now all this time that the woman goes around, the bride goes around in a veil, which means that nobody else, now she's spoken for, nobody else can have her. And she is conscious that at any time the bridegroom can come and pick her up. And it will probably be at night. So she's got her oil lamp ready with the oil next to it, and she's got her wedding dress all packed, she's got a towel, she's got stuff that, you know, I don't know what women, but you know, she's got her stuff. It's all ready. And she's got a hairbrush, just, you know, because she's obviously not going to know when she'll want to brush her hair. And at a particular point, the dad says, right, off you go and get her. So he goes to the village, and there's a procession with him, and there's a lot of shouting. Nowadays it would be car horns and things, but in those days, a lot of shouting and probably donkeys, you know, all kinds of noise. And the bride sort of wakes up and says, hey, you know. Now, this is an important part of the ceremony. The bride actually has to be kidnapped, as long as she agrees to be kidnapped. And I say this has been perverted in parts of the Muslim world and parts of the Soviet Muslim, well, basically the Muslim world. You go and kidnap a girl, she hasn't agreed to it. And this is still happening to this day. But provided the bride wants to be kidnapped, it can be quite a romantic thing. The man comes in at night and scoops her off onto his camel and off they go, or donkey or whatever it is. And then, so they go to the place which is prepared, his father's house, and they have a brief ceremony under what is called a chuppah. Do you know what a chuppah is? Right, a chuppah is basically a piece of cloth, like a canopy, held up by four poles. And under that, they repeat their vows to each other, and they're married. Now, I've been to several Jewish weddings. One Jewish wedding, they had the chuppah held up by four M16 rifles, you know, one on each corner. But that was on one kibbutz I was on. But it could be pitchforks. It could be, anyway, it's held up in four corners. And then, that's quite a brief ceremony. But then, what happens is they have to consummate the marriage, because the marriage is not legal until it's consummated. I think you all know what I mean by consummate a marriage. So off they go into the place where they're prepared. And then the best man is standing outside the door. And when it's consummated, the husband will say, it's done, you know. And so the celebration can start. And so the best man says the marriage is now legal, and there are now 7 days of celebrations. The bride and the groom take no part in this. They're sort of doing other things. But the ceremony carries on for 7 days. And after 7 days, the bride and the groom join the party, and they have a great big meal together. And then the husband takes his bride back to the village where they will be living. And that is more or less a Jewish wedding as it was practiced traditionally. Now, I would like to turn to... We need to go into the Bible at some point, don't we? Turn to Genesis 24, verse 1. There is a very interesting passage of the Bible describing Isaac's wedding, and I'll read this chapter, Genesis 24, verse 1. Now Abraham was old, well advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abraham said to the oldest servant of his house, who ruled over all that he had, please put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but you shall go to my country and to my family and take a wife for my son Isaac. So that was an old vow that they used to take. Put the hand under the thigh means swear on my generations, on my descendants. Verse 5. The servant said to him, perhaps the woman will not be able to follow me to this land. Must I take your son back to the land from which you came? But Abraham said to him, beware that you do not take my son back there. The Lord God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my family, and who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. He will send his angels before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. And if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be released from this oath. Only do not take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham his master and swore to him concerning this matter. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, for all his master's goods were in his hand. I think this was Eliezer, his name was. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made his camels kneel down outside the city by a well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. Then he said, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, please give me success this day, and show kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, here I stand by a well of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now let it be that the young woman to whom I say, please let down your pitcher that I may drink, and she says, drink, and I will also give your camels a drink, let her be the one you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. And it happened, before he had finished speaking, that behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her pitcher on her shoulder. Now the young woman was very beautiful to behold, a virgin, no man had known her, and she went down to the well, filled her pitcher, and came up. And the servant ran to meet her and said, please let me drink a little water from your pitcher. So she said, drink, my lord. Then she quickly let her pitcher down to her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also until you have finished drinking. Then she quickly emptied her pitcher into the trough, ran back to the well to draw water, and drew for all his camels. And the man, wondering at her, remained silent, so as to know whether the Lord had made his journey prosperous or not. So it was, when the camels had finished drinking, that the man took a golden nose ring weighing half a shekel, and 2 bracelets for her wrists weighing 10 shekels of gold, and said, whose daughter are you? Tell me, please, is there room in your father's house for us to lodge? So she said to him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, Milcah's son, whom she bore to Nahor. Moreover, she said to him, we have both straw and feed enough, and we have room to lodge. Then the man bowed down his head and worshipped the Lord, and he said, blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth towards my master. As for me, being on the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren. So the young woman ran and told her mother's household these things. Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. And Laban ran out to the man by the well. So it came to pass when he saw the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrists, and when he heard the words of his sister Rebekah saying, thus the man said to me, that he went to the man. And there he stood by the camels at the well. And he said, come in, O blessed of the Lord, why do you stand outside? For I have prepared the house and a place for the camels. Then the man came to the house, and he unloaded her camels and provided straw and feed for the camels and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. Food was set before him to eat, but he said, I will not eat until I have told about my errand. And he said, speak on. Now, from verse 34 to verse 48, is basically he's repeating all it, so I won't repeat that again. So, verse 50, then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing comes from the Lord. We cannot speak to you either bad or good. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go. And let your master's son's wife, let her be your master's son's wife, as the Lord has spoken. And it came to pass when Abraham's servants heard their words that he worshipped the Lord, bowing himself to the earth. Then the servant brought out jewelry of silver, jewelry of gold, and clothing, and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. And he and the men who were with him ate and drank and stayed all night. Then they rose in the morning, and he said, "Send me away to my master." But her brother and her mother said, "Let the young men stay with us, woman, stay with us a few days, at least 10. After that she may go." But he said, "Do not hinder me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away so that I may go to my master." So they said, "We will call the young woman and ask her personally." Then they called Rebekah and said to him, "Do you want to go with this man? Or will you go with this man?" And she said, "I want to go." So they sent away Rebekah, their sister, and her nurse, and Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said, "Our sister, may you become the mother of thousands, of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gates of those who hate you." Then Rebekah and her maids arose, and they rode on the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. Now Isaac came from the way of Beer Lahai-Roi, for he dwelt in the Negev, the south it says here, but the Negev is where he... And Isaac went out to meditate in the field in the evening, and he lifted his eyes and looked, and there the camels were coming. Then Rebekah lifted her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from her camel. For she said to the servant, "Who is this man walking in the field to meet us?" The servant said, "It is my master." So she took a veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So that's a pretty complete record of a traditional marriage of the time. You had the betrothal, she had to agree, and then obviously it was much shorter than a year, but the same sort of principle. And we can tie this very much into us today. As I say, it was Jewish weddings and Jesus. Now, as I said before, it was the Father who arranges who the man marries. And it's God the Father who arranged the marriage of Jesus to his bride. And I've lost my train of thought. I just thought of something else. But so it's the Father who arranged the marriage. And what happened was the son had to pay a price for the bride. And what price did Jesus pay for us? He paid with his life. He paid with his blood. And the just as the bridegroom and the bride shared a glass of wine and they drank to each other as a sign of the covenant, we today have the bread and the wine as a sign of the price that Jesus paid for us. And that means we are engaged, we are betrothed to Jesus. We can't be betrothed to any other God or any other demon. We are betrothed to Jesus. And as I've mentioned before, when we are engaged in this culture, it's not such a big thing if it's broken. But in that culture, all the promises are made at the time when you're betrothed. Now, I happen to know this personally because in 1976, I was working in the Jerusalem office of Ambassador College. And once a year, we had to take our vehicle out of the country and bring it back, because if we didn't, we would have to pay some exorbitant tax, about nine times the actual value of the vehicle. So 1976, it was just after the Turkish invasion, I think, of Cyprus. I had to drive to Haifa, put it on the boat, go to Cyprus, and then come back after a week, bring the vehicle back into the country. So after about 3 days, I got bored of sightseeing. I'd seen Limassol, I'd seen Nicosia, I'd seen it all. And I ended up in this cafe in Limassol. I was the only one. It was a cafe usually frequented by British servicemen. I was the only one in there at the time, except for the waitress, and she was very grumpy at the time, very, very grumpy indeed. And she served me, and she was saying things like, "I hate people. If there were no people in this world, I'd be so happy, you know." I think she'd just been dumped by a British squaddy. And anyway, I ended up working there for about three days. I wiped the tables and served the customers, and you know, and they fed me very well. And after about 3 days, we were behind the bar together, this girl, Maria, I think her name was, and she was talking Greek, and she's Greek to me, frankly, but she was talking Greek, and the guy in front of the counter smiled and shook my hand and said, "Congratulations." So I turned her and I sort of, "What's going on?" I sort of playfully grabbed her around the neck and said, "What's going on?" And she admitted that she said we'd been engaged, we were engaged, and we weren't. But the reason I mention this is that to the shame of many of the British troops there, when they got bored of Cyprus, they would get engaged to a local Greek girl, and then they would break it off. And then the RAF had to fly them out within 24 hours, or that man would get his throat cut. Because betrothal is a very, very serious thing in that culture, just the same as it was in the Jewish culture. You can get your throat cut if you break it. So we are betrothed, not just engaged, we are betrothed to the Son of God, to Jesus. And he is going to prepare a place for us. And then at some point he's going to come back and get us. Now, in the past, I've always subscribed to the old Worldwide Church of God view that we go and join Jesus when he comes back on the Mount of Olives. Now, I'm coming round to that's the post-tribulation, we go up in the air syndrome. There's three. There's pre-tribulation, we go up in the air. There's mid-tribulation, we go up in the air. And there's post-tribulation, we go up in the air. So, because of this study, I'm coming more to the pre-trib, you know. Jesus comes back, and then we go to meet him, and then there is the marriage of the Lamb in heaven. And then 7 years during the tribulation, this goes on. Now, I'm not making this is sort of what I know there are a lot of different shades of opinion on this. So this, I'm coming to believe, is the correct one. The church goes up, and marriage of the Lamb, and then for 7 years, celebrations go on. And then the Lamb and the Bride come out, and they're shown to everybody, and then they come back to earth at that point. As I say, I've got more studying to do on that, but it seems a pretty logical if you look at the Bible. So I thought I'd share this with you just to build a little bit on what Joy was speaking about a couple of months ago, I think it was. And because there's been a bit of a gap in my thinking, anyway, enjoy your week. And now I've got to be disconnected.